the way down to your toes. You had no magic in that river bubble. It might as well have been the vacuum of space before you had built the furnace within yourself. Your necromancy was as still and dead as the room itself. It was surprising how badly it frightened you. It was only you and your mind's outline of your body, and the ghost of a dead man, and the thing that followed you inside. The door held as both of you strained against it. The next rattle made the hinges squeal in agony. Palamedes looked at you and opened his mouth to say something as a third rattle flung you both back a little, your heads knocked together, and then you heard the deliberate steel rasp of a trigger being cocked. Sextus was rubbing his temple and looking at you, awestruck, as though he had seen some stupefying glimpse of the beyond. You did not remotely understand the sharp smile that suddenly crossed his face. "Kill us twice. Shame on God," he said, and he leaned forward, and much to your intense distress, he swiftly kissed your brow. Then he said, "Harrowhark, for pity's sake, go!" You dropped back under, and you did not hear the gunshot. You were, not for the first time, overwhelmed with the suspicion that you were standing in the middle of what you had thought to be scenery, only to reach out and discover that it was all so much flimsy. You were not a central lever within a mystery, but a bystander watching a charlatan display a trick. Your eyes had followed a bright light or colour, and you realized with a start that you ought to have been watching the other hand. You were standing in a darkened corridor, and you could not turn around. And then a brief explosion of light revealed to you that it wasn't a corridor at all, and it had never been dark. But you were always too quick to mourn your own ignorance. You never could have guessed that he had seen me. Chapter 34. When you sat up, struggling for breaths you did not need to take, wet only with the sweat trickling under the dormant bones of your exoskeleton, you saw not the canopy of trees overhead, but a filmy white length of sheeting. You had been moved. You were lying down flat, not bent in the curved posture that you had been taught to adopt, and your sword was tucked beneath your arm, and you had been upended onto a thin blanket that nonetheless let you feel each blade of grass and uneven mound of turf beneath, and feel the beating sun overhead, and hear the shrill host of outside creatures. Camilla Hecht sat beside you, and she did not flinch when you sat up all at once. You were in a larger clearing, with a huge mess of crushed boughs beside you, some of which had been pressed into service to hold up the tent you lay beneath. Beyond the tent curved the great metal belly of a shuttle. Your mind idiotically focused upon its bizarre shape and style. It was not a cohort shuttle, nor any kind of shuttle of the Nine Houses, and not only because it had not been adorned with even a single bone. It was made of very shiny silver steel, and its heat treatment made it sizzle, with a sort of wobbling radiance sitting just above the hull. It was also thoroughly battered and singed. You would not have flown it 10 feet above the ground, let alone into atmosphere or the black depths of space. It was small, no more than 3 bodies wide and 3 bodies tall, and the thought of being forced inside curdled you. But your distaste and paranoia were stopped in mid-swing by Camilla saying with barely repressed intensity, "So?" you said, "He's in there." The cavalier of the 6th house looked at you. Then she collapsed back in a long, controlled movement. She lay flat on her back, staring sightlessly at the sky, half-shadowed by the sheeting, half-glowing in the light. At last she gave a long, shuddering breath and sat back up with the same abruptness. "Good," she said, and she smiled very briefly. This smile lit the corners of her face like a rising comet. It made her look, in fact, ridiculously like her adept. What now? You held the carefully assembled fragments of skull between your hands and hoped that he is had not become he was. Then you crushed the bone between your fingers. The cavalier next to you reached out reflexively, then stopped herself, and you kneaded the fragments within your palms until you could winnow out the glue, which, thank God, had been chemical in nature. It might have very easily been derived from keratin, which would have been a momentary confusion and annoyance. The glue was expunged as a knotty collection of gummy nodules, which you discarded, and left you with a thanagy-rich clay. You considered this malleable stuff for a moment before knitting it between your hands. Phalanges spurted from the mass, then a distal row, then a proximal row of carpal bones and a length of articulated wrist. It was not the sheer animal pleasure of Vianthe's arm, but it was easy and it was satisfying. You said, "I could simply give you a full skeleton frame." "Don't," said Camilla quickly, and paused, and said, "That's going to get me in trouble." "The warden specifically requested movement." "I don't mean him," said his cavalier. You tossed her the hand bones, and she caught them on reflex. You grasped your sword and stood, and before she could prevent you, you walked around the side of the bizarre shuttle. There was some manner of open cargo delivery hatch, or means of entrance, with the door hoisted up on a jack so that fresh air could circulate within the shuttle. You stood in the blinking sunlight before this open door on the flattened grass, and you looked inside. The three inhabitants stared back at you. The first was Captain Deuterus, a woman whose stretched-out corpse you had last seen riddled with bullets. She was sitting, not in her cohort whites, but in a drab long-sleeved shirt of indeterminate colour and dark trousers. She looked like a shell of the crisp adept you had seen back at Canaan House, and less robust even than her corpse. She had lost significant weight from her already fragile necromancer's build. Her cheeks were dark hollows, and she clasped two crutches in her lap. Another woman sat close beside her, wearing her own shabby shirt of indeterminate colour, but as though it had been designed for her royal use. A woman you had last seen calmly falling to her death. Ianthe Tridentarius's features stared out of Coronabeth's face. An aurora of a face, with deep lustrous skin and burnished hair and eyes of genuine violet, like plums. Both women were seated in the back of the poorly furnished shuttle, amid crude engines set in oil-reeking array beneath a thin metal grill, and a mess of boxes piled in every corner. Yet the Crown Princess of Ida, missing and presumed dead, filled up that space like a mass of flowers on a midden. She was in as blooming good health as could be, as vigorous as Deuterus was frail. The third staring inhabitant was not a person. It was an enormous flimsy poster in a chipped frame, the only sign of decoration in that untidy little shuttle. A head and shoulders photograph of an unsmiling, adamant person, in all assumption a woman, stared fixedly at you as though calculating how much effort it would take to snap your neck. She was dressed in black to the chin, and her red hair curled thickly about her neck and shoulders. Thick, itchy streams of blood began to ooze down your sinuses. That portrait frightened you more than anything you had seen since becoming a lictor. It scared the irresolute piss from your body. Yet you had never seen the face before in your life. The second house captain said, somewhat hoarsely, "Ninth?" You wiped your face before your hands flew to your exoskeleton again. It disgorged one of the 22 with ease, and you pulled open the letter marked, "To open if you meet Judith Deuterus." You translated without conscious thought. addressing the Lady Harrow Hark Nona Jesmus, known as the Reverend Daughter by her own desire, now Harrow Hark the First, from the same, now dead. Letter 12 of 24. If you meet Judith Deuteros, silence her. Kill her if necessary. The bones of Deuteros's jaw fused shut. You glued her bottom molars to her top molars immediately and cleaved her tongue to her palate. She said, You took out a second letter, to be sure, although this one was in plain script and you had read it already. Addressing the Lady Harrow Hark Nona Jesmus, known as the Reverend Daughter by her own desire, now Harrow Hark the First, from the same, now dead. Letter 5 of 24. Protect Coronabeth Tridentarius at all costs, even if this endangers your life. The work is forfeit if you contribute to her death by direct or indirect action. In the interests of the work, you may silence her, so long as this causes her no significant pain. In different handwriting. P.S. or any pain at all. In yours. P.P.S. I cannot guarantee a total absence of pain. The First Amender. P.P.P.S. There must be a total absence of pain, actually. In yours again. P.P.P.P.S. We have jointly agreed on as little pain as may be achieved via the fullness of necromantic effort. And in the first, P.P.P.P.P.S. XOXOXOXO. Coronabeth Tridentarius had already leapt to her feet and unsheathed a rapier you knew very well and which froze you to the core to behold. It was a ninth house rapier. The blade was black metal, with a plain guard and a hilt of the same colour. She stood before the mute shell that now constituted Deuteros, neatly at the ready with the rapier brandished and her left arm tucked behind her back. It was so like looking at Ianthe that you were differently bewildered. But you had already done the same to her, the tongue to the roof of the mouth, the teeth to the teeth, and so all she could say was, You drew your two-handed sword. Stop it! The sixth cavalier had joined this shitty tableau. She narrowed her eyes to slits in the sunshine. I warned them already. I do this on a greater authority than your own. Balls, said Hecht succinctly. Let them go. Then, why is that sword gummed up, and who taught you to hold it like that? I refuse to... What? Your hands are too close together. Put your left hand at the bottom of the pommel. Tuck in the arm close to the chest. Right hand high on the hilt, close to the crossguard. Up a bit with your thumb. Yeah, that's more like it. You did all this, and she said, Good. Not like you have the muscle for a rising strike. Okay, now let Coronabeth and Judith go. Your grip adjusted. You found it significantly less difficult to hold the sword pointed down than previously. You asked, Why are you here? Why are you all alive? Why are you on the other side of the universe, in your own shuttle, innumerable years away from the Nine Houses? Why were your bodies not found at Canaan House? With her mouth a gruesome, stuck-together distortion, Deuteros had stood with a crutch shakily clutched beneath one arm, and was now hauling herself toward you with an uprightness of posture that belied her physical weakness. It was still the cohort captain who silently approached, her dark eyes cold and level. You kept your bone-sheathed sword steady, though you would not, in any case, use it to kill her if you have to. The captain shouldered past an obviously reluctant Coronabeth. Their eyes met, and Judith shook her head in a minute no, and she stopped about a step before you. Then she grabbed a fistful of mother-of-pearl robes. You did not flinch. She said, as though sheer force of desperation could wrench coherent sound from a fused mouth. Camilla flew to her left side and Corona to her right, but she swung her crutch at them. Her grasp was surprisingly strong, and as she said, "Woo!" you unfused lips, tongue and teeth. You always were too curious for your own good.
"Nyah! Warn him, Lictor. He has been infiltrated, dammit, and I can do nothing. I am a prisoner of war. If you love him, tell the Emperor that the traitor has already..."
This last was nothing to do with you. Coronabeth, face set, had clasped her hand over the second house's mouth and manhandled her backward, which was very easy for someone of the third's stature to do to someone of the second's. Ianthe's twin was stone-eyed, and the expression she and the captain gave each other was antagonistic, to say the least. Judith was humiliatingly bundled back within the confines of the shuttle. Coronabeth kicked a lever close to the door. The great shady overhead hatch started winding down, and you watched the darkness claim her and the furious dignity of the downed soldier beneath the cold gaze of that too familiar portrait. Judith was signing something to you, but you could not make out cohort signals. You'd never bothered yourself with the military. Camilla was picking up the crutch. She said restlessly, "Look, we should go. We weren't meant to be here." You said, "You are a fool if you think I will let you leave like..."
"I evoke the rock that is never rolled away," she said instantly.
She was a quick study.
"Let us leave. Tell no one we were here. Don't ask any more questions. We're not on the same side anymore, Ninth. I owe you. I owe you everything. But things have changed."
It was your turn for your tongue to cleave to the roof of your mouth. The once cavalier of the sixth house looked at you impassively, and she said, "I'm sorry, if that helps." You said, "It doesn't."
"Fair.
Let me ask one thing," you said. "One single question, just the one, for the sake of what I have just done for you, and for the Master Warden of the sixth house." Camilla looked at you distantly, and eventually said, "Ask. I'm not going to promise that I can answer." You said, "Who took you away from Kanan House? Who are you with, Hecht?"
"You call them Blood of Eden," she said.
That evening, Mercy Morn came to fetch you from the surface of a planet you had killed, with almost no thought to its murder. Indeed, you had felt almost nothing, and you said very little, which met your teacher's needs excellently, as she had nothing to say to you except, "You smell like dirt." She piloted you back to the Mithraeum in silence. You watched the retreating planet out the window, and it looked no different, except that perhaps the deep water that lined the equator in chilly, juxtaposed slabs of ice seemed more cracked and turbid than previous. It was safely dead, with its cavorting animal populace unaware of their long-term death sentence. Worms crawled within the miserable, fetid pit of you.
Chapter 35.
"I am sorry, Ninth," Abigail said, in the same hesitantly kind and careful tones you might use to tell someone that their cat would never grow up into a tiger. "I'm not at all an expert in psychometry, and with such an old rapier, you'd need both a sixth house specialist and to get awfully lucky. It was your grandmother's 9 generations back, you said, and it was handled briefly?"
"That,"
came the soft, funereal voice of Harrowhark's cavalier, softer and more funereal filtered through his muffler,
"was the nature of the condescension.
And the blade has been replaced.
The hilt is original, barring the grip."
Pause.
"And parts of the basket."
"Right. No chance of it being bled on?"
"It was handled. She told stories of how the balance of the sword was complemented. It would have been touched for perhaps 20 to 30 seconds.
"With gloves on?"
"That is customary."
"Autos," she said.
I'm not trained for this. I think our chances are very small. I think we've got a similar chance of Magnus tripping over the secret entrance to the lost chambers of the Emperor Undying. Actually, that's significantly less unlikely, as I've come to believe they run sidelong to the facility rather than... Never mind. Sir, I am truly, truly sorry, but... Reverend Daughter, is that you? It was not likely to be anybody else standing on the threshold, unwilling to cross over and listen to the rest of the conversation. Harrowhark had been standing in profound silence, without so much as the rustle of a fold of robe, but the necromancer of the Fifth House had demonstrated extraordinarily acute hearing for eavesdroppers. "We're used to Jean and Isaac, you know," she had said, as though that constituted an explanation all by itself. No hope of disappearing back into the corridor, or taking refuge in audacity and answering no. The Reverend Daughter swept into the frozen library as though she had been noticed at the moment of entry, and found the Fifth and her swordsman apparent standing before a rack of old and crunchy maps. He had his fragile, rusty sword balanced courteously on his palms before the mild-eyed adept, and she had been rubbing a sort of clear balm over the knobbled base. Ortus, as blackly gowned, deep-eyed, and sadly painted as ever, had taken to wearing his black canvas panniers all the time. His hood was recklessly pushed away from his freshly shaven head. It took a sense of duty shading into martyrdom to shave in these conditions, and he looked rather as though he had been caught opening birthday presents a day early. His breath emanated from the black scarf around his face and nose as a pale mist. The bloody fog had turned to sleet. The sleet had, in its time, turned to ice. A soft snow began falling like volcanic ash about a week after the first hailstorm. Banks of snow piled up through the cracks in the windows and blew loose into everyone's faces in the more exposed halls and ways of Canaan House. Sometimes the snow fell red, and the ice settling into the cracks of the paving stones and the steel of the dock terraces was a deep, unsettling carmine. The fresh vegetables had died, and they were down to preserved food. The rainbow-girdled constructs had kept fishing in the still-moving salt sea, but Teacher had taken one look at their catch and refused to have it cooked, or to let anyone else even see it. Nonetheless, the snow and the bloody ice proved to be the least of the changes facing Canaan House. Ortus sheathed his rapier with more care than finesse, and he asked, "How fare the preparations, lady?" At exactly the same time Abigail said, "You shouldn't really be walking unaccompanied, Harrow. Quinn and Dias were with me until the end of the corridor. We've laid all the wards," she said. Harrow had not bothered with scarf or muffler, and every so often regretted it. Her lips were cracked, and so were her paints. No matter how much she powdered herself beforehand, which gave her skull the appearance of a worn-down fresco. No matter their efficacy, they'll tell us something. If the sleeper trips them while moving, that will tell us one thing. If the sleeper doesn't trip them while moving, that will tell us another.
You did not attempt to move the coffin, her cavalier said, with only the faintest flicker of hope.
Of course I did, said Harrow, and he briefly closed his eyes in a full-face wince. Nothing. It is absolutely immovable. Dias pried up the panelling to see how far down it extends. It is laid like a pillar. I didn't hold out too much hope that we could simply drop the thing into the ocean, but I admit to being disconcerted.
He said, "Mistress, you might have woken it up."
And that would have told me something else, she said.
I wish that you would not take such enormous liberties with your own life,
Harrowhark said. Would you rather I took enormous liberties with yours, and did not intend it to be unkind, had thought it even faintly reassuring? But Ortis's dark eyes chilled in their sockets, as though the icy cold had reached them also, and his lips curled downward, and he said slowly,
That is my purpose, yes.
You hate the facility. It makes you sweat. You have begged not to be taken down there.
Yes,
he said. Then try not to mourn when everything goes according to your request, said Harrow. And then they were both irritated. She knew that he was irritated because a conversation had not gone the way he'd overplanned it, and she knew that she was irritated because each time she tried to blunt the razor edge of her tongue, he somehow grasped the blades of her anyway. Nothing in their exchange had been less than typical of the locked tomb, and yet ever since she had come to Canaan House, she had found it all wanting somehow. She did nothing to stanch the flow when she said, "Are we in agreement? Are we clear?"
"Thoroughly,"
said her cavalier sadly. Abigail had been making herself look busy as only a member of the Fifth House could. Harrowhark was learning that a scion of the Fifth House might busy themselves politely during a murder or an orgy. Now she said briskly, "I'm glad you're here, Harrow. I wanted to talk to you about what happens next." She sat down at the table and tossed her thick, painstakingly brushed sheets of smooth brown hair behind her. Abigail Pent would present smartly in Earthquake, Fire or Flood, and Harrowhark said, "I assume you mean the organs." "Yes, those aren't great," said Pent. The snow had settled. The ice, in pinkish, crackling drifts, had formed miniature fern-like cherry-shaded patterns on all the ancient glass. In their wake, great, slithering, pulsing tubes had worked themselves up through the cracks in the floorboards or wound down among the frozen weeds. The tubes were a fresh, clear pink, with redder veins beneath the translucent topmost layer. At intervals, black clusters swam within, this way and that, like frightened fish. When one cut them, they bled a gush of filthy water, then the wound closed up as one watched. The cold had deepened to the point where a few hours would freeze this substance solid, a sort of brownish cloud with a misty, gelid surface. The tubes were not homogeneous. Every so often they would pouch out or fall in dramatic drapes along the wall or from the ceiling, with whitish, pearl-bubbled globules secreted away within their flesh. The surviving inhabitants of Canaan House were united, even Harrow, in agreement with Dulcie Septimus's pronouncement that it was absolutely ghastly, bordering on shitty. Abigail considered Harrow gravely, with her hands tucked into a pair of her husband's outsized woolly gloves, and she said, "Reverend daughter, we look to you." Harrowhark had been looked to before, though rarely by anyone under 70 years old. She kept her gloved fingers within the folds of her robe, flexing them occasionally, and waited. The fifth historian continued, "My necromantic scholarship is specific. My general practice, scattershot. I never did hold ambitions in that quarter. I can command a skeleton, but I can't create one. I can work tendon or a muscle, or settle skin into a gash. But if that can be weaponized, I'd love to know how. And as for the Duchess Septimus..." All things considered, Dulcinea Septimus was a medical miracle. By her own account, her lungs were blown-out sacks of inflammation from the last round of pneumonia she had fought before her voyage to the House of the First. The cold ought to have already buried her beneath those deep cerise snows outside. But there was seemingly very little wrong with her, apart from the occasional cough. Harrowhark had been ready to denounce her as a lifelong hypochondriac, except that Septimus herself was the first to insist as much. "I have always said that thinking one is sick is probably what makes you sickest," she once said hopefully, while avoiding attempts on her cavalier's part to feed her evil-smelling linctus from a spoon. Abigail said, "She should be incapacitated. It's marvellous that she isn't. But her flesh magic is inward supporting. She says the Master Warden of the Sixth House gave her instruction when they were children, though goodness knows he would have been, what, 9 years old, and that she neglected her other studies. You, the Lieutenant, and Protesilaus the Seventh constitute our front line. Harrow Hark very specifically did not look at her cavalier to see how he took this pronouncement. He had formed a violent passion against the heroic knight of the Seventh House. She thought it was nice that he had a hobby. She said, "If the temperature drops further, I am in danger of becoming less useful. I have been experimenting with heating marrow to stop it from freezing, an art I have, as far as I can tell, only just invented, but it is fiendishly difficult. I do not admit this lightly." "Oh, damn," the fifth necromancer said softly. Damn, I hadn't even thought of that. I mean, gosh, that's fascinating. You ought to tell me the details at some point, but damn!" Harrow Hark rubbed her hands against her ribs through her robes and gloves and said, "This is all precaution. I'm still fit for purpose, so long as the temperature doesn't fall."
"Then time is against us," said Autus.
"Time was always against us," said Abigail. "Oh, time, said a voice from the doorway. "Time means very little." "Mastery does. This temple stood for 10,000 years untouched by all but time's clumsiest pawing, but then its master was the master, for whom even the river will part. Time is nothing to the king everlasting." It was Teacher. He wore his white woolen tunic with its beautiful rainbow sash and his sandals and a little white half-cape, but nothing else to keep out the cold. He had a bottle of apple-coloured liquid in his hand that he took a pull from every so often, the sharp reek of which made Harrow's nose crinkle. To their silence he added,
"I believe we are now being punished for what they did. Even the devil bent for God to put a leash around her neck. And the disciples were scared. I cannot blame them. I was terrified. But when the work was done, when I was finished, and so were they, and the new lictors found out the price, they bade him kill the saltwater creature before she could do them harm. Oh, but it is a tragedy to be put in a box and laid to wait for the rest of time. It happened to me, but I was only a man, or perhaps 50 men. Reverend daughter, your whole house treads upon a knife's edge as keepers of such a zoo."
He caught her gaze on the bottle, and his very blue eyes twinkled a little madly, and he said with greater calm,
"It's thistle shrub, child. I could not get drunk on it if I tried. And how I have tried."
Autus said,
"You speak in riddles, old man."
"Then let me speak plainly," said Teacher. "You worship a monster in a box and play at being the masters of its tomb. Now we have a monster in a box, and it has become obvious that it means to master us all. Canaan House has never changed its colour, nor its shape, nor with the seasons. I should know. We measured summer to winter, temperature and precipitation and the acidity of the very sea beneath us, and it never hailed, and it never snowed, and we certainly never saw Fimbrie hanging from the rafters. Let me prophesy in my old age. The sleeper is getting up the strength to wake completely and colonize what it finds. I fear. God, how I fear!"
Abigail said, "Teacher, please come and take up residence with us. We have beds. We keep watches." But he cried out,
"And miss out on the chance to die! I've been wandering these halls at 3 o'clock in the morning, saying at the top of my voice, 'It would be terrible to be shot!' and the sleeper still does not come. It is dreadful to be shown a monster's pity."
He pivoted abruptly and took another long suck at the bottle.
"Your swords will not rend its armour," he said, with his back turned to them. "Its weapons will ruin your flesh. It will not stop until it has subsumed its quarry, and it would only acknowledge the blade without. All we have are the blades within. It has seen them and made them dull. There is no hero left among us, and I say, hooray!"
Teacher, in a mad, sprightly dash, clicked his heels together with the ardour and energy of a man a quarter of his age.
"Hooray!" he said again. "Into the river with us, boys! 50 can score like fishes!"
And he threw his bottle violently at the nearest section of tube out in the corridor. Harrowhark watched as the shiny red organ gave out a wet, squishy blarp. The bottle bounced off it dismally, and as Abigail and Autus drew close beside her, it rolled sadly beneath another fold of wet, curtaining pink. Some of the bitter fluid within spilt out onto the battered wooden floor. Within seconds, even the ends of that alcohol began to flake into shards of ice.
"It's coming for you, Reverend Daughter," said Teacher. "Oh, it's coming for you. And once it's got you, once that rock's rolled away, once that tomb's levered open, the Emperor of the Nine Houses will never know peace ever again. The King is dead. Long live the King!"
Teacher capered madly down the hallway like a child, slapping at long, shivering, droplet-shaped lumps of viscous and whooping as he went. His hooting and hollering rang off the antique walls long after he disappeared. Harrow felt the cold as an old friend inside the thick black canvas of her church robe. Her fingers burnt as though she had held them too close to a fire. Her cavalier and the historian did not warm her as they stood beside her. It was as though she were alone in the room. She was startled when the latter touched her, laid her hand on her shoulder as though she were no older than one of the vanished fourth house duo, a gawky little girl in the face of death.
"Well, bugger teacher," said Abigail Pent crossly.
Chapter 36. 1 week before the Emperor's murder. In those last long, terrible days before the end, those strangled, claustrophobic, white-faced days that stalked the borders of your nights like predators waiting for your collapse, you began to pray again. This was not because you had anyone in particular to pray to. It just helped, in its own ineffable way, to read your knucklebone prayer beads and to recite childhood meditations you had learned when you were yet too small to look out over the pew. You were filled with the baffling memory of Mortus the Ninth lifting you up to see your mother leading Mass. Before you were allowed on the sanctuary, you were seated in front and held by your father's cavalier, so that you might not stare at a softly powdered stone chairback for the whole session. You remembered that you had far preferred the strong, sad hands of Mortus to being sat next to your great-aunts and given a stinging piece of peppermint candy to suck, as though you ever needed to be kept quiet. It had been the last assumption of immaturity you would ever enjoy. You had been 3 years old, maybe. If you prayed for anything, you prayed for clarity. You prayed that you might look upon the face of each remaining lictor and that the body would quietly point to the apostate. You prayed that it had been Kithareia, traitor even in death, and that her body had somehow been tossed out of the Mithraeum's airlock. You prayed that the whole thing had been an illusion, and sometimes nearly convinced yourself that it was, that you had imagined the dead of Canaan House alive again, impossibly drifting through the jungles of your victim planet, far away from where their bodies had gone to rest.
But then why had their coffins on the Erebos been empty? And why now was one of your letters missing and another two freshly opened? Whenever you thought about it, enervated lines of thick, hot blood drooled from each ear so that your canals were perennially stained deep brown. You prayed to live just a few more weeks. 1 month ago, after you distractedly slit the jugular of your 14th planet, you were praying thus when a great alarm began pounding through the halls of the Mithraeum. You did not recognize the klaxon. Red lights replaced the soothing blue glow of the habitation lamps lining the walls, strobing anxiously on and off. And then a huge shutter slid over your window. You stood in front of the weirdly bending, echoing light in front of the plex, and you watched a great metal panel crunch into place with a silent grinding and huge vibration, slowly cutting out the light. Your rooms grew profoundly dark, except for that excited red blinking. The klaxon continued as you were left in that red-hued darkness, tight with anticipation, ready to die. The voice of the Emperor of the Nine Houses rasped over the comm speaker beside your door, and you rushed to stand before it as he said, "JG calling in. All clear. Lictors, do you copy?" "AA calling in. All clear."
"GP calling in. All clear."
A pause. Then you heard Ianthe's cool, detached tones, as if she hadn't even been asleep. "No one has yet seen fit to grace me with a call sign, but nonetheless, all clear." "Augustine." "Your IN, of course. Harrow's H." "Yes? Harrow's H." "HO calling in," you said instantly. And you ignored Ianthe's audible sniggers. "All clear. What's going on?" And God said urgently,
"Mercy, do you copy? Who pulled the alarm?"
The communicator crackled. Somebody breathed deeply. Then there was a lowing over the system. A terrible animal call of uncomprehending pain, and it did not sound like the Saint of Joy. It sounded like a shower of static and a bitten-off sob, and then a great, wet, horrible thump. The Emperor said,
"Someone unlock my door so I can get to her."
Orta said,
"I'm closer."
Another wet noise of contact. Then Mercy said hoarsely,
"No, no, I am coherent. I just... less than a second of visual. I looked away, Lord, but it was... optically magnified. There in the centre. It is here. The resurrection beast has come. The seventh colossus. Brood of that which murdered Cyrus the First. Packmate of that which murdered Ulysses the First. The one and the same that Cassiopeia died for. Oh God, John, sometimes I wish I were capable of dying. I saw it. I saw it, and it is blue like Loveday's eyes. It knows what you did to its kin, and it sees my cavalier's mortal soul burning in my chest."
The mechanical clank of a door unlocking was also audible over the line. The Emperor said,
"Thanks,"
and then his side of the communication cut off. Nobody else spoke on the line. The klaxon ended. It kept ringing in your ears long after it was gone. Augustine's voice crackled over the line quite wearily. "What a dolt. She knows not to look within a kilometre of the thing's predicted arrival. Well, it's here early, and so are we. Back to bed, everyone." And you went back to bed. The shutters did not come up again. You would learn that they would not. You would learn that the Mithraeum would only be privy to even more shielding in the days ahead, lest the Emperor of the Nine Houses look upon what approached. But that night you just lay next to the body, and you noticed that her eyes were open very wide, and that in the darkness they were death mask gold. You said,
"Beloved?"
She said,
"It's coming."
With the most anticipatory astonishment you had ever heard in her low, many-personed voice. Right then she used the voice of your father's cavalier, and...
"It's near."
Had she ever been astonished before? Had she ever been uneasy? You were lying face to face with her, centimetres from the wet sheen of her skin that ought to have made an imprint on your pillow, facing that crinkled lower lip. Her eyes, which the nightlights had turned the sick amber of a healing bruise, stared through you. The body was troubled. In that hovering place so close to the end of your life, it seemed only natural that you should reach for her. The fear of death had remade your worship into desperation, or maybe desire. You reached one hand out for that frozen tangle of hair at the back of the skull. You closed the gap between you, and you kissed that lovely corpse mouth. Of course you could not. There was nothing there. Contact made her drift away, just as with any of your hallucinations. You had not touched her. Maybe you had not even reached for her. The body watched you with an expression you were terribly afraid was pity. You said, "Please," and you reached out again. A wave of dizziness rocked you. You pushed at the robe lying crooked at the slope of her shoulder. You pressed your hand low to her belly. Her dignity was untouched by this gross urgency, this coarse frenzy. Or maybe, again, you had not done it. You said again, "Please." As though you had crossed no boundary, and above the soundless rough shouting in your ears, the body said, "I have to go away for a while." And you regretted everything. "I have done wrong," you said. There was the tiniest suggestion of a furrow in that cool, unbreathing brow, and she said, "How?" You did not begin to know how to answer that. The body reached out and stroked her fingers forward, as though to close your eyes. You were too tired to imagine how those fingertips would feel on your lids, how that thumb might brush down the bridge of your nose. You closed your eyes in obedient response, and then, you poor broken-hearted sad sack, you fell deeply asleep. In the morning, the body was gone.
"Here is the strategy for engagement," said Mercy Morne.
She had wheeled a large piece of opaque white plex before the dinner table where you and Ianthe and Augustine and Autus were seated, clustered close to her, with the Emperor at the end of the table busying himself with his own work, with his tablet and his diagrams, with his styluses and flimsy. By this point, it had been nearly 2 months since the death of the 14th planet. All the window shutters had been down for weeks. This contributed to a general sense of living inside a box, which you did not mind. There were no windows in Dreaba, though there had always been a sense of depth that made you feel freer than you did upon this flat collection of rings and corridors. Your teacher stood before this assembled throng in her Canaanite robe, looking fragile as a white flower with a rotten peach heart, and she said,
"The engagement could go on for 3 hours. It could go on for 8. It could go on for a week. Assume that timing is labile, and proceed accordingly. Next."
The Saint of Joy drew a large cylindrical tube on the plex whiteboard with a fat black soft-tip pen. She segmented and labelled the cylinder from top to bottom, each a neat interval apart. Epiroic, Mesaroic, Batheroic, Barathron.
"The greatest portion of the fight will take place here, as normal," she said, emphatically underlining Epiroic. "We must use the bank as much as possible. Once the beast tires, you'll know, because it will try to run. We wrestle it down to the Mesaroic layer, then the Batheroic, and then to Barathron. Once we're there, the stoma will open, and we push it through. Simple."
"Not,"
Mercy Morne added acidly, in case anyone had mistaken her. Autus said,
"I maintain we should drive it downward at the start."
No, thanks. Not all of us are spearfishers. Next, she said.
But the saint of duty wasn't done. As he occasionally did, he ground forward with the force of gravity and added doggedly,
Our swiftest fight against a beast took place in the Batheroic lair.
Yes, and number 8 wasn't tired by the time we got to the Barathron, and Ulysses the First had to wrestle it through the stoma, and he is, as we speak, languishing in hell. It's a resurrection beast, honey. Thank you. Next!
From the end of the table, his white-ringed eyes still bent down upon his papers, the Emperor said quietly,
His was the action of a hero.
Oh, but the problem is that heroes always die, said Augustine, who was worrying an edge of tablecloth between his long and elegant fingers. You can't even really pronounce one a hero until they die heroically. I thought the downward assault was a good wheeze when you two first came up with it, Autus. But we know now that the last push against a beast has to be sudden and conclusive. I'd rather have fought 9 more hours than have Ulysses sitting here right now, inciting a sexy party, than have watched him wrestle that thing out of sight.
I hated the sexy parties, said Mercy Morn, with an almost tearful vehemence,
and Augustine said, We know, Joy. We know. You had been watching Ianthe. She could not bear meetings or any kind of organized activity where she might be forced to deal with anyone else's opinion, which you found strange considering that she had spent her entire life at the hip of her twin sister. She was sitting in her chair with her pallid arm crossed across the shiny gold of her skeleton one, both framed hideously against the coalescing rainbow whites of her robe. Her hair fell in thin, straight sheets over her shoulders, and she rested the back of her head against the chair back, as though she might nap at any moment. She looked to you. You looked away quickly, but you had been caught watching. Lately, you found yourself praying that the traitor was not Ianthe, all the while having seen for yourself the living Coronabeth in the arms of Blood of Eden, the twin who, as far as you could tell, was the only human being Ianthe loved more than herself. For the sake of this sister, Ianthe had held your gaze while sliding a knife through the palm of your hand. Why did you pray for Ianthe's innocence when it was so dubious? It was not the way of the Ninth House to pray with such willful credulousness. Yet you prayed all the while knowing Ianthe's facility for tergiversation would have given the whole universe pause. That wanton backstabber said idly, What about the physical form? Is it really invulnerable?
At its current trajectory, I have triangulated that it will perch.
Here, said Mercy, and fixed a map of local space to the plex with round magnets. You were bewildered by how far the perch seemed from the Mithraeum. Your erstwhile tutor had pegged its location at, if the diagram read true, somewhere in the orbit of a planet 5 billion kilometers away.
The asteroid field means that we'll only get waves of heralds around 25,000 strong. It can't all outrush us.
Ianthe said, We know where it is. Bomb it.
We tried that, duckling, as I've told you, said her teacher, but quite kindly.
He had removed his kit of rolling papers and pouch of evil-looking innards and had begun to roll a cigarette.
The layer of dead matter and heralds is 2,000 kilometers thick.
Send a lictor to penetrate the layer. Plant the bomb close up. I'll do it, if courage fails in the hearts of my elders. Autus said,
Tried that.
And Mercy said,
Kitherea was mad for weeks, and I do not mean mad cross, I mean mad insane. She didn't even touch on the surface.
It's not that getting rid of the corpus wouldn't be useful, said the Emperor. It would be. When Cyrus drew the corpus into a black hole, Ulysses said that it was the simplest thing in the world to dispose of the brain, that it fell into a dormant state, and he could bring it down to a stoma single-handed. But that cost us Cyrus. And Cassiopeia drove the body into the river alongside its own brain. But only Cassie could have ever done that. Or Augustine. It was halfway to a question. Augustine said, "I'm not Cassie, John. It's all theoretical to me." And God said, "I hope it stays theoretical. Anyway, the damn thing hardly seemed to care. Put the heralds aside, Ianthe. Leave them to your sword hand." You said,
"And how to defeat the beast? What does it look like? How will it attack us? What must we expect?"
Mercy Morn took her fat-tipped marker and scribbled on the plex, placing her new object squarely in the epiroic layer.
"This is the beast," she said.
Augustine said, "That's a muffin." "I see a cloud, but with a face," said Ianthe, "if you take that main squiggle for an eye." You said,
"I thought it was a flower," and God said,
"No, yes, I agree. There's something fluorescent about it." And Ortis said,
"Thought it was a snake in a bush."
"I hate you all," said Mercy Morn passionately. "I have hated you for millennia, except you, my lord."
"Thanks," said God.
"I merely want to put you in a jail," said his lictor, now meditative. "And fill up the jail with acid, once for every time you made a frivolous remark, or ate peanuts in a cohort admiralty meeting, or said, 'What would I know? I'm only God.' Then, at the end of 1,000 years, you would say, 'Mercy, I have learned not to do any of these things because I hated the acid you put on me.' And I would say, 'That is why I did it, Lord. I did it for you and for your empire.' I often think about this," she finished.
The Emperor of the Nine Houses said,
"I ate peanuts discreetly, the once."
You said,
"Let us continue on the assumption that the diagram is the beast." "Yes, thank you," said your teacher, "except that I noted your use of the assumption, and I would like to remind you, infant, that I also hated you on sight. The beast brain will sit in the epiroic layer, and it will attack us in any way it chooses. Each beast is different. I have fought numerous now, and each beast is quite unlike any other. Number 2 spewed quicksilver and remade itself into 100-foot spikes. Number 6 kept sucking us into enormous sphincters and spraying us with worms. I cannot even remember what it looked like. I remember number 4. It was a humanoid creature with a beautiful face who held me under the water, and it spoke in a lovely voice, but it only repeated, 'Die, die,' and I recall number 1 as a great and incoherent machine. When I saw it, I thought it had a great tail and 1,000 broken pillars on its back, but Cassiopeia saw it as a mechanical monster with swords for wings and great horns of myelin tessellated over with graves."
It was the Saint of Duty who said restlessly,
"Number 8 was a giant head."
"Finned like a fish," said Augustine, lost in reverie. "Its ribs were bloody bandages, and its teeth protruded through its own skull, tangled about its face like a nest. It was red, and it had a single eye of green that moved all about the body. Look," he said, coming back to himself, perhaps seeing something in your and Ianthe's expressions. "They're not great, is what we are saying." Ianthe said, "Then this is a waste of time, eldest sister. We can't plan on fighting it."
"We can arrange our formation," said the Saint of Joy primly. "Take your own section of the beast and concentrate. You, idiot baby, will take the east. Augustine will take the west. Ortis, the north. I will take southmost to its central point, whatever that point looks like, and whatever it may be. It may be we can't even comprehend it spatially, but at that point, fight it and get out of everyone else's way."
You said, "What about me?" No one looked at you except for Mercy Morn. Ianthe's gaze was fixed in some totally different direction, perhaps her appointed east. Augustine was lighting a neatly rolled cigarette,
and the saint of duty simply studied the shield pulled down over the wide window that it used to look out into space. Even God did not look up from whatever administrative work concerned the prince undying. The only eyes for you were Mercy's. That endless, red-shaded hurricane, sinking into those sandy brown depths, moving over the face of grey waters.
"Just don't get in the way," she said.
Augustine said smoothly, "See where you're needed, sis. It may be that the beast has some vulnerability you can mark, or it may try to attack us from without, which means you'll be useful on the perimeter.
Keep flexible."
This would have been a perfectly reasonable request, had its meaning not been so obvious. Do not distract us with your death. The kindly prince said idly,
"He's right, Harrowhark. From what I can tell, it's useful to have someone who can move laterally rather than being obliged to keep to one place. And in any case, like most best-laid plans, this one won't survive contact with the enemy. Do what you feel is best, and everyone else will endeavour not to swamp your skeletons. Can we have a tea break, Mercy? I'm gasping."
Your sister, closest in age, did not stand, as everyone else did, at God's request to put the kettle on. She was still looking at the black diagram, and she asked, quite unconcernedly, "What is the stoma?" Mercy said,
"Augustine, you did tell her about the stoma," in tones of accusation, but he simply said,
"No, I saw no reason to frighten her. Why? Did you tell Harrowhark?" "Naturally, you had not been told about the stoma," your teacher simply said fractiously.
"She'll never see it. Why bother?"
"If I have my way, we'll leave Ianthe safely in the Mesoroic. We three old lags will be more than enough to take it down," said Augustine sharply. Ianthe's languid, brown-spotted gaze dragged up to him as though it barely had the energy to do so. "That thing has a ferocious gravitational pull. It's not for neophytes."
"Excuse me, we may not all of us be alive by the time the thing is exhausted, so I would stop swaddling your squalling baby."
"You never did take the stoma seriously, which is why your whole damned house sucks at it like a grotesque teat."
"Don't be coarse."
"It is the mouth to hell," said God. He stood in the liminal space between dining room and kitchen, the biscuit tin clutched in his hands. There were crease marks on his clothes from too much wearing, and there was a faint smudge of blue where he had been writing with ink and touched his temple. He said,
"A genuinely chaotic space. Chaos in the meaning of the abyss, as well as unfathomable, located at the bottom of the river. The riverbed is studded with mouths that open at proximity of resurrection beasts, and no ghosts venture deeper than the Batheroic layer. Anyone who has entered a stoma has never returned. It is a portal to the place I cannot touch, somewhere I don't fully comprehend, where my power and my authority are utterly meaningless. You'll find very few ghosts sink as far as the Barathrun. If I believed in sin, I would say they died weighted down with sin, placing them nearer the trash space. That's what we've been using it for, in any case. That's where we put the resurrection beasts, the rubbish bin, with all the other dross."
Then he said,
"So who wants a bicky?"
Chapter 37. The atmosphere on the Mithraeum crystallized into hot, waiting agony. You would walk down a hallway and find Augustine and Autus fighting, their eyelids glued together in pink, smarting lines as they sparred blind in tight corners, rapiers flashing like light over water, then stopping apparently at random, before the saint of patience would say something like, "Okay, again, but airless," and you would hear a sudden pounding wheeze as both of them emptied the air from their lungs. Generally, you then took another corridor. The lictors also did what they perhaps should have from the very start, an organized, loosely planned, often contradictory sessions of instruction for Ianthe and for you. You went en masse into the river, leaving your bodies behind to slump into sea curves, or at least yours did, the rest of them stood, and crunched the silvery sand of the bank beneath your feet as the three saints led you both to assemble wards. No blood or flesh or bone here. The first two might be scavenged, the last swept away by the capricious tide. You collected bits of dried wood. Dried wood? And empty coloured stones. Stones? From the banks of the river beyond death. And you collected armfuls of the sharply unkind osiers and tall feathery plants, the ones with long fibrous stems as tall as you were, and thin tangled leaves. Filthy salt wind whipped your faces as you formed wards from the flotsam that grew, apparently, on the bank. And no ghosts passed you to wade down to the water. No ghosts heaved themselves out of the waters of the layer that Mercy Morn had called the